Welcome, everyone. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thanks, all. Welcome to the cancer work group call for hematology and melanoma. And today we're walking through seven measures, and the process will be that the lead discussants for the measures will open the discussion and give their highlights of the measure and their thoughts about the measure and any concerns and any questions they may have for the developer. They will also make a note of those. And then we'll open it up for discussion by the full work group. And the first... The first measure we're going to have up for discussion is measure number 378. Dr. Trotner is the lead discussant for that. And 378 is documentation of iron stores in patients receiving, I don't know how to pronounce it. Therapy. Thank you.
Okay. I need a little bit of guidance about how you exactly want this to be done.
Sure. If you could give your thoughts about the measure as you were evaluating the measure and your recommendation, and walk us through it, and then we will discuss as a group what other folks on the group had to say about the measure.
So you want to walk through each impact and everything?
Yes, that would be great.
Okay, so if we start with impact, I think the prevalence of the disease isn't really well laid out here. How many patients actually qualify for supplemental erythropoietin? So I think it's moderate impact if I were guessing about the number of patients who are affected. The opportunity for improvement, I need your help. Under 1B1, under the benefits, the paragraph is totally nonsensical. I think I know what they mean, which is that if one is using supplemental erythropoietin, you need to be sure you don't make the patient iron deficient, but that's not how the paragraph came out. But the problem I'm having is I don't understand the performance gap data, and I wonder if you could walk us through exactly what those percentiles mean.
Is there anyone from AMAPCCI who can speak to this?
Hi, this is Sam Tierney with the AMA. I guess I'll ask if any of our colleagues from testing are on the phone. I'm sorry, we might be taking the calls in different locations, and I'm not sure.
Because I admit, this is Sam Silver. I share this with Elaine. I had a very difficult time understanding the definitions of the data presented, and so I really didn't understand these forms.
Yeah. My sense from all of the measures that I reviewed is that the performance gap data all came from an analysis of what's been submitted thus far on the PQRI and PQRS, and that none of these data are readily available. So I need to take them at face value. I think they're saying that a certain percentage of physicians performed the measure adequately, but I don't understand how they go down in deciles, in quartiles. So I can't make any comment on the performance gap because I don't understand it.
Okay.
Do any of the other reviewers understand it?
This is Joe Laver from St. Jude. I didn't understand it at all.
Sam, did you have anyone who could speak to the performance gap issues?
Well, I mean, there are no data provided on performance gap other than those statistics that none of us understand. So, I mean, the question is, are hematologists checking iron stores in patients who receive erythropoietin, and whether that's happening or not is something we can't assess outside of the data from the 2008 measure.
Hi, this is Molly from the AMA. We are trying to figure out a way to bring someone in from our testing team who can speak more to the performance data from PQRS. Thanks.
Okay. So if I go through that until they bring somebody, the rest of the data, the citations for the data, the summary, there isn't anything there other than the 2008 and 2009 performance measures. So I guess we'll skip over that. Going on to the evidence, the only evidence that's provided for this measure is the clinical practice guideline, and the one they quote is from the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. There is actually an American Society of Hematology guideline on the use of erythropoietin stimulating agents, and checking iron stores is recommended, vital. I don't know how else. I think it's the standard of care. So the question becomes, I can't provide you with evidence. They haven't provided us with any randomized trials. All we really have are the guidelines. Consistency, net benefit. The net benefit isn't provided. I know what it is. It's not in the measure. And the rest of this is really something that they quote verbatim for each of the measures. It goes back to the NCCN guidelines. The NCCN guidelines use their own level of evidence, and this one would fall into 2A, which is based upon recommendations without a high level of consensus, without its lower level evidence, but consensus. Okay, so a specific guideline recommendation, very straightforward, the use of supplemental iron in patients receiving erythropoietin stimulating agents. The hard part about this measure is that it only requires that iron stores be checked. It doesn't require, as the guideline would recommend, that iron stores be repleted. So the measure doesn't go that far. Reliability and validity, I think we probably need the AMA people there again, too, because I really don't understand how they're presenting the reliability and validity data. I don't think it's a conflict of interest for me to say that my practice was one of the two that the AMA came out to audit to get these data, so I do know how it was done, and I can tell you that if it would help the other members of the committee.
Okay, is that in the, it's not clear in the form, is that right?
Well, knowing how they did it in my practice, I'm not quite sure how the data were derived from that. Because, basically my impression when they came to the practice was that I gave them the denominator. So I was able, through our practice management system, to pull out all of the patients who had a diagnosis of a myelodysplastic syndrome, who had been seen in the office over the previous year, who had received supplemental erythropoietin, so that those codes were easy to put together. And that was the denominator. The numerator was whether we had checked iron stores, and that was somewhat difficult for them, and they did go through our electronic medical record and some of the hospital charts, and so that was the numerator. And I did not think that they were looking so much for our performance as they were just looking to see that the data could be easily extracted. And then after they did that part, we did give them, we were able to pull the PQRI forms, again, through our billing system for the patients where we had submitted a code, and they could go back and see if what we had submitted on the code was actually documented in our medical record.
Okay.
That was the process that they used. But, again, I don't really understand how that translates into the reliability and validity testing, and it would be helpful if somebody could explain that to me. Hello?
Thank you. I just wondered if someone from the AMA could speak to that, or if they're still waiting, that's fine. You can go on with your discussion or recommendation on this one.
Angela, this is Sam with the AMA. We do have our testing staff, Amaris Crawford, on the phone now. So sorry, apologies for the delay. Thanks for your patience.
sorry that I'm late. So your specific question is about the deciles that we were able to capture for the hematology.
Well, the first question is going back. How did you? What do these figures mean for the performance gap, the quartiles?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, we take that information from the PQRS data, and what it basically represents is the number of physicians that are actually submitting this information, and whether they're submitting it, the performance that they're actually showing. So if you look at this particular measure, you'll notice that most of the physicians land in the 90th percentile. However,
so,
the gap in care is...
which paragraph, which section are you quoting?
I'm sorry, this is Opportunity for Improvement 1B.2.
1B.2, we have data demonstrating performance.
Right. And you asked for the gap in care, correct?
So the 90th percentile, what did 97.44% of physicians do?
That basically means that 97.44% of the physicians who reported were in the 90th percentile. They basically were 58% of the patients reported on did not meet the measure, but 97.44% of the physicians, each time they submitted, were submitting accurately.
Accurately, but non-concordantly.
Exactly.
Okay. And can you explain how that translates into performance gap?
Well, it's showing that there's actually a need for this measure because not everyone is actually performing at the standard or where they should be, which is at 100th percentile.
So only 58% of the reporting physicians, even though 97% of them gave good data, only 58% had concordant measures.
Exactly. So 97.4% of them were actually reporting correctly, but 58% of those patients didn't actually meet the measure.
So they reported, the physicians reported that they did not meet the measure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the other thing which I'm trying to understand are the reliability and validity data.
Sorry, give me a moment. I'm going to flip to that section.
2A2.
So for the measure, 2A2, overall, there was a 90% agreement that that this measure is reliable based on the abstraction. And for validity, which section, what part of validity are you referring to specifically? Which of the data?
Frequency distribution of ratings. I guess it's mostly the validity testing. Well,
questions on how it works, or is it the answers by the work group?
I guess it's actually the validity testing is not the issue. It was the reliability. But reliability, you're basically saying that what was reported correctly?
Yes.
And how do you know that? Is that chart review? Is that primary source review that you do?
That's chart review.
That was what they did in my practice. They went through every single chart to see if what we told them was really in there.
So let me get this straight. The reliability depends upon your practice, Elaine, and then...
And Tim's.
And Tim's practice. So I make the comment that... knowing both these practices, they were looking at reliability in practices that have incredibly high would have a high expected rate of reliability, and I don't think that that's typical.
And it was only 30 patients.
Okay.
So threats to validity, I didn't have anything there. Identification, if we go down to 2B5 then, identification of meaningful differences in performance, again, no data other than the data from the earlier quality reporting initiative. And disparities, comparability wasn't done. Disparities in care, nothing identified here to look at disparities. The information that's provided in there is really not related at all to what the measure is testing. Use in public reporting, again, this is a kind of a cookie cutter thing that they put in for all of the different measures. And I mean, basically, I'm skipping to the end. The problem I had when I went through this is that while I might feel that it's very important to document and to supplement iron in patients receiving erythropoietin stimulating agents, if you had me go through this form as we did in our initial conference call and judge it on the basis of impact, for impact, I'm not sure I have enough data. It doesn't meet the evidence criteria simply because there's not enough presented in the measure. And the performance gap, there's really no information other than the previous PQRS data. So I have a problem with the measure as it's structured right now.
Okay, thank you. Are there other comments from the work group members?
Yeah, this is Bob Miller. So this is a very generic comment, but I guess the uncertainty I had is since all of these measures have previously been approved by NQF, I mean, these are all reviews, if you will, if I'm understanding this correctly.
That's correct.
So I guess that clearly colored my review of the one measure I was assigned to in all of them that I commented on, which is to say that, like I think I'm hearing in my fellow work group members' voices, we had a lot of uncertainty as to whether we were simply to go by the materials presented in this one word document, obviously influenced by our clinical judgment for those of us clinicians. But what assumptions are we to make that, you know, some like panel at NQF 3 years ago went through the same process and must have assumed that at some point in time these measures met the appropriate criteria, that they were of high impact and they were appropriately reliable. So maybe someone from NQF could speak to that before we go any further, because I made my decisions were based a lot on knowing that somebody else had blessed this before me.
Sure. This is what happened was this is a maintenance measure, as you noted, and our criteria has changed a bit in the interim. It's a little more stringent now, possibly than at the time that this measure was considered and endorsed initially. So keep that in mind, and the measure has to be reviewed on today's criteria.
And we do expect that the measure developer provides all the information into the measure submission form, but we also put it before you all because we expect that you have outside knowledge that may incline you to support the measure or not support the measure. That information you may want to make the measure developer aware of if you believe that it's missing something that could strengthen the measure that would make it meet the current criteria. Same as if you know of studies that are out there that wouldn't support the measure, we would ask that you raise those to the attention of the developer and the steering committee too. Does that help at all?
I guess. You know, one of the issues with this particular measure is that because the FDA has a REMS program for erythropoietin stimulating agents, the myelodysplastic syndromes fall outside that. It doesn't need to be part of that program. So we've kind of picked the only area that doesn't fall under such stringent control. But, you know, at the University of Michigan, we have, for the other patients, a very robust program that specifically manages the anemia patient receiving these ESAs, and those patients have monthly monitoring of blood counts, they've got monthly monitoring of iron, they receive iron replacement. So there is a very good quality program in place, but it's mandated by the FDA, so I'm not sure if that really counts as a quality measure. And I'm just not sure about the importance of taking this one separate group of patients and addressing it differently. Does that make sense?
That does, and that's certainly something that we would ask you and the rest of the steering committee members to really weigh as you make your decision.
Sam, do you have feelings about this measure?
So there are a couple of things. I mean, one is that these are expensive agents given to a group of patients that do fall outside of FDA labeling criteria, that is, patients with myelodysplastic syndrome. And I think more and more, because of the stringency of the FDA REMS criteria, I think a higher and higher percent of patients around the country are with hematologic diseases are actually hematology and oncology are getting ESAs because of MDS, and because these measures fall outside of the REMS, that may give it even more weight that there be some oversight about whether physicians are appropriately giving ESAs. That is, they should not be giving ESAs to any patient with MDS who's iron deficient, because that would be a using ESAs inappropriately. You know, I should say, and you didn't ask for this, about conflicts of interest. Do you care about that?
Yes, we do.
So I should say two things. One, I'm vice chair of the board of directors of the NCCN, a non-paid position. So that's one. And number two, I'm a consultant for Amgen that makes ESAs. I don't give talks, but I am a consultant for Amgen. And actually, I was co-author of the first meta-analysis that said that there could be major negative effects with cancer patients with the use of ESAs. So I'm not necessarily a positive person, and you know who consults for Amgen in this light, but I thought I should say both those things. So number one, I think the very fact that this is not part of the REMS may make it more important. Number two, that at least older data, my surprise, because that there was 68% non-compliance with this measure, says that there is a huge gap and inappropriate use of ESAs for patients with MDS. I think that the measure could be further improved, because looking at this document, it doesn't talk at all about, I mean, nor is there anything in any guideline that actually talks about the frequency of determining iron stores. Because you could have done iron stores 11 months before. Is that adequate for starting ESAs? That remains unsaid, and that would be considered concordant. That's number one. And number two, I am concerned about the availability of the appropriate data in an electronic health record system. Because even though you would be able to determine whether ferritin was performed, or iron and total iron binding capacity, being able to determine whether there were iron stores on an appropriately stained bone marrow aspirate might be very difficult, because that would be part of text in a pathology report.
Mm-hmm.
One would hope that all that information would be available, because we collect it for all the other patients getting ESAs.
So I do understand that, but I don't know if it's collected in any sort of a standardized form that would be part of a electronic health record system? I don't know that answer.
Well, you know, when they came to our practice, is a mess because our practice over there had a document retrieval system. So when they went to look for the ferritins, they had to leaf through pages of scanned in laboratory tests.
But my bottom line is, I think that even though this does not rise to a metric that looks at randomized clinical trial, you know, we know the biology of ESAs in patients who are iron deficient. We know that they should be iron replete before they get ESAs, and that some understanding of the patient's iron stores should be measured before these expensive agents are, and that there is apparently a major gap, which actually surprises me.
And I don't disagree with Sam. The problem for me was when you make me go through these forms and I get to a certain checkbox and it says stop. You know, I agree that it's a quality measure. It doesn't fall in line with the checkboxes, so I don't know how stringent you're going to be on those criteria.
We would say that, I think as the previous speaker was saying, if it is good practice and it makes sense that the measure meets the patient need, even without randomized controlled trials, test data, and things like that, and the measure is strong enough as written, that can be taken into consideration.
Now there is a part, you know, kind of a part B that was unsaid in this measure that I do agree with Elaine, that you know, and it doesn't ask this, and you know, and the day when we were asked to deliver measures, it didn't necessarily ask us to have a measure and then a follow-up part A and part B, but Elaine's question is, okay, so the patient's you've done the test and the iron level's low, you know, and you give the ASA anyway, you know, you've basically fulfilled the criteria of having measured it. You haven't looked at it. Should there be a part B that says, you know, if you know the ferritin is less than such, I think it was 100. You know, if the iron over TIBC is less than 20%, if the marrow doesn't show stainable iron in the erythrocytic series, then you need to replete the iron, replace the iron before administering ESAs. So that's not part of this, and so that would be kind of a multi-part, you know, a quality measure, but that's not what was asked for initially, and I don't know what to do with that.
Well, Sam, could we recommend a modification of the measure to say that it requires documentation of adequate iron stores within 4 weeks of initiating ESAs?
Well, I think that would be reasonable.
I agree.
Yes.
Okay, we have a consensus.
I'm all in.
It adds in a lot more useful specificity, I think. It turns us into a clinically useful metric as opposed to a curiosity.
I agree.
Is someone from AMA, PCPI, could they speak to that, if that's possible?
Yeah, this is Sam Tierney. I mean, that's something that we could take back to the work group. You know, the measure was originally developed for use in the PQRI program, which is a program that takes place on an annual basis, which I think is would explain some of the reason that the measure looks at it on an annual basis, if you will. But I think that we've seen with the move of the PQRS program to registries and the use of EHRs that we have more capabilities now to define certain timeframes. And so that's certainly something that we could take back to the work group for consideration. We do have a process by which we have to consider changes, and so we have to get the clinical expert panel that originally developed the measures to agree to such changes.
So I just so I'm not the only person from the American Society of Hematology who's talking about this, Tim, what is that suggestion?
I think it's a fine suggestion if it's workable, you know, to do that. And it, when you look at numerator and denominator analysis, it has, you know, I think that's part of the problem why this got hung up is that simplicity is much more workable typically. And so this is, you're adding a two-step process, and whether that's workable under the way that they look at this, I don't know. But I think, but obviously from a clinical standpoint, that makes more sense. And so, And just to add, since I got the floor just for a second, I'm unaware of gap data. Elaine and Sam probably are more in touch with that, but just other sources, other studies that would provide this gap data. I think just in and of itself, this is an important piece of information, just addressing gap information that probably wasn't known before. I think in and of itself, the measure serves that function. It's just the question is, how does one respond to it?
This is Sam Tierney with the AMA. If I could just add one other thing to Dr. Miley's point. I know that there was some concern related to the data we presented for the performance gap, but unfortunately, there is not any data available in the medical literature that speaks to a gap related to this particular practice. So the only data that we really have available to us is from the PQRS program. And I can certainly understand the concerns with how that was presented, and perhaps we could modify it so that it's more clear. But I just wanted to make everyone aware that, and I think for many of the other hematology measures, there really just isn't data available from the medical literature, so we have to rely on the data from the PQRS program to support the measure in terms of a gap or opportunity for improvement.
Kind of a general comment about the practice of hematology is that we, you know, see many low incidence diseases. We have all of these small silos, and we do not have a national database, you know, that looks at these things. And so the issue of gap analysis in hematology, and I would say, and my melanoma colleagues on the phone would have to talk about this, that I was chair of the quality committee for ASCO a little while ago, that gap data for oncology in general, at least medical oncology, is lacking and is being accumulated as we speak. So it's a tough issue.
All right. Any other comments about the measure? Any recommendation from the work group, initial recommendation on this measure?
I guess, Elaine, my recommendation would be to approve, but to recommend, if possible, that modification.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Trautner. We went a little bit out of order. We'll go back to measure number 377, MDS and acute leukemias, baseline cytogenic testing performed on bone marrow. And Dr. Alvernus is our lead discussant for that measure. And Dr. Alvernus, as we talked about a little bit earlier, we would like for you to give your highlights of the measure, walk us through it a bit, and give us your concerns and your initial recommendation, and then we'll throw it open for the group.
Great. I will, I'm sorry, I'm trying to pull this up on my computer. I apologize. I had been on the other side of campus when the meeting started, and apologize.
We had a lively discussion. That's the on 378. No problem.
If it's going to take you a minute, we can probably jump to another measure. It's up to you.
That'd be okay. I'm sorry. I'm just had been locked out of my computer when I got back into my office. So if we could do another measure next, that would be really helpful. I apologize for that.
Okay. Then we'll move on to measure 379. Is Dr. Dale on the line? No. Okay. Well, then let's move on to number 380, multiple myeloma treatment with bisphosphonate. And Dr. Fields had already spoken to us. She's not able to join this particular call, but she did provide her comments to us, and we'll read them out to the committee.
So which doctor is it? Fields' first name?
Karen.
Karen Fields.
Oh, Karen Fields, okay.
Karen Fields.
Yeah. The whole world, you know everybody.
Okay.
Are you able to
see
it? So she provided us her written comments, and we'll go ahead and read those and ask the group for discussion.
So for importance, Dr. Fields, for under high impact, she said that it had moderate high impact. For opportunity for improvement, it was high, and her rationale was that the authors of the study cite that this is an issue of high impact in that it affects a large number of patients, approximately 20,000 patients diagnosed annually. And under the opportunity for improvement, the authors note that there is a significant performance gap and cite that during the previous monitoring period, 47.4% of the patients reported did not meet the measure. She said that this is a health outcome, and when rating the evidence, she said for the quantity it was moderate, quality was moderate, and consistency was high. She provided rationale saying that the supporting literature is of moderate to high quality and quantity with the following limitations. Randomized trials include patients diagnosed with lytic lesions, and the supporting literature supports treatment in a different patient population than the study measure. MM not in remission does not account for the presence of only lytic lesions, but could include osteoporosis and osteopenia. However, it is rational to administer these drugs in patients with MM not in remission, given the natural history of the disease. Several randomized trials include the use of an oral medication. The exclusion criteria, the absence of bone disease, dental disease, renal disease may not always be well documented. So in terms of the evidence, she did rate that it met the decision logic. Looking at scientific acceptability, she said high for reliability and validity testing, and provide a little bit of rationale saying that previously endorsed measure, this is a previously endorsed measure, the interval study data demonstrated a high degree of reliability and validity with the measure. Reliability assessments of exceptions and other parameters confirm the utility of this measure. For usability, she rated it moderate. And then looking at feasibility, she said it was highly feasible and recommended the measure for overall endorsement. So we're going to open it up to the rest of the work group and see if they have any concerns or issues.
This is Elaine. I agree with her assessment. My only concern was, and again, it has to do with how often you look at the measure, that giving a bisphosphonate once a year is probably not meeting the measure, but that's how it's written. I think the standard of care would be to give the bisphosphonate monthly, or some people think every 3 months that's being looked at in clinical trials, but once a year doesn't really meet it.
I agree. This is Miller.
Okay. Anyone from AMA-PCPI, is that a change that you could make?
This is Sam Tierney again. So again, you know, we'd have to take that back to the work group for consideration. I know in the discussions with the work group, there was, you know, agreement that once a year is certainly not enough, and that this is a treatment that's usually given on a more regular basis, you know, perhaps monthly. However, given the focus on trying to have it included in a program that assesses things annually, you know, we kind of made some modifications, but I think it's something that we could certainly reconsider and take back to the group for consideration.
Okay with me?
Yes.
Okay. Any other comments from the other work group members who looked at the measure?
I have a question. This is Miller. I have a question. This is 2B1.1 under validity. The question is, describe how the specifications are consistent with the evidence cited. So I just don't understand your answer. And there were several, and I'm saying this more because this applied to several of the measures, including the melanoma measure that I looked at. The answer, while I know what you're getting at, is sort of non-responsive to the question. There's a difference between our measure and the evidence. Our measure focuses only on myeloma. I didn't think that's what the question's asking. The question is this measure test what it's supposed to test, right? You know, the validity testing that follows is the data that's put forth to justify that it does. But I'm just totally missing this. But it seems like that's not really the question. My understanding of validity is this a valid test? I'm defining it with a word, but I mean, does this test show us? Does this measure define what we're really getting at here? And I don't know that I can see this from these documents, which goes back to my earlier concern that since I know this is a reanalysis of previous work that someone's looked at, you couldn't draw that conclusion just from this 19-page Word document. So I don't know if anyone else had the same concern, but I just wanted to share that before we got too much further in this.
Is the measure developer there? Can they speak to that? AMA?
Hi, this is Sam Tierney again. I guess I would just say our interpretation of that question has been different. You know, although it's in the validity section, the question seemed to us to be asking how the specifics of the measure, either the measure focus or the target population, are consistent with the evidence, which is actually similar to a question that's asked in the previous section. So we have typically answered it in the same way. I think it would be helpful if that is not the intent, if NQF staff could give us further guidance as to what that question actually means. I think we had been interpreting it differently.
In the validity section, it's basically, if the measure's speaking to was purported to measure. And that's kind of the response that we're looking for in that section.
The reliability section is where we're actually asking you to pull out whether the, for example, the data elements are reliably captured in the way that you've specified, things like that. But the validity is the overall measure as it's specified. Is it capturing what it is intended to capture?
Okay. Any other work group comments on this one? We've already heard about from the work group about some questions around strengthening the measure with the administration of the bisphosphonate. Anything else that we have to add to that? Okay. So the overall recommendation I think that we had from Dr. Fields was a recommend, and I just wanted to check with the rest of the committee how they feel about the measure. Recommend with or simply recommend?
Recommend with if possible.
Okay. All right.
Dr. Alvarez, are you ready for 377?
I am. I apologize. Between a new computer and a broken foot, I think I'm ready to go. So I'll start out with a disclaimer, which is in terms of conflict of interest, I'm on the NCCN ALL panel. I'm co-chair of that. I don't have any relationships with any pharmaceutical companies. I thought that this measure was, with respect to myelodysplastic syndrome and acute leukemias, an important one. This is a baseline testing of the bone marrow karyotype prior to initiation of therapy. It is defined at least and the measure as being relevant to both patients with myelodysplastic syndromes and acute leukemias. The numerator were those who actually had that testing performed upon the bone marrow. The denominator would be all patients with the aforementioned diagnoses. And just going through your list, in terms of the evidence for this, I think this is something that is broadly supported, and the levels of evidence would include not only the numerous papers that have used karyotype as an important stratifier amongst risk groups in those patients with AML as well as those with myelodysplasia. It's included in both of the, I think, the most relevant prognostic scoring systems, the one based out of the World Health Organization as well as the IPSS. The karyotypic pattern is referred to in the World Health Organization classification for both of these disease entities as a way of further describing rather and achieving specificity in that entity. And I think broadly throughout a number of studies, including randomized trials, these karyotype has played a role in outcomes differences amongst groups of patients. The other conflict of interest that I'll tell you about is that I'm a bone marrow transplanter. And with respect to transplant, which plays an important role in the NCCN algorithms for the management of both of these entities, karyotype plays, I would say, if not the central role, an extraordinarily important role in deciding which path of treatment, conventional dose, non-transplant therapies versus transplant therapies, are offered to patients who would be otherwise considered hematopoietic stem cell transplant candidates. So I do believe that there is a broad and relatively deep body of literature that supports this as a metric. I think that that in terms of the actual measurability, I would have some concerns about how best to abstract out those data amongst patients who've had this diagnosis and the assessment. So in terms of a practical implementation, I'll have questions for you in that regard, but I think this is supported. One of the things that I was concerned about in the description of the measure is, in terms of the brief description of benefits, at least as the metric is articulated in the header, it's myelodysplastic syndromes and acute leukemias, baseline cytogenetics testing. And much of the body to which the metric refers, much of the subsequent supporting description refers only to myelodysplasia. So I think one of my first concerns about this is I think we want to be very careful how we define this. If this is myelodysplastic syndrome and acute leukemias, then we're talking about a lot of different entities. The myelodysplastic syndromes, acute myelogenous leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, all entities for which I think karyotypic evaluation plays an extraordinarily important role, but as the measure is defined, it fails to articulate all of those elements. If we want to be particular to MDS, then we should define it as MDS or MDS that has evolved to acute myelogenous leukemia. If we want to apply it broadly, and I would be very supportive of that because I think this is important, then I think we want to be careful in all the supporting documentation that it reflects that breadth of the measure, because there's some inconsistencies as this is written to whom it refers. And I think that inconsistency is reflected in the differences between the title, between the articulated numerator, the denominator, and then the subsequent description of the metric. So I think in terms of importance, rationale, and body of evidence, I think all these things can be supported. On the other hand, I think that we have to be very, very careful how this metric is defined, and I have concerns with the lack of specificity or at least the inconsistency to which the different disease entities are referred to in the body of this metric.
This is Sam Silver. I think that the part of point of view of the American Society of Hematology, we wanted to include myelodysplasia and all acute leukemias, AML and ALL, and not just those that derived from a previous myelodysplastic syndrome. And therefore, the appropriate ICD-9 or in the future ICD-10 codes should parallel that.
I agree with you, and I would be extraordinarily enthusiastic about that breadth of definition, because I think for all those disease entities, and again, I'm speaking as a selfishly as a transplanter, I find many patients in the community in part mismanaged because their risk at the time of diagnosis was never adequately assessed due to a failure to do this very central and important element of patient evaluation. So I'm a very enthusiastic backer of what you've just articulated.
Yeah, and actually that's exactly where this came from. It actually was led by, you know, more by the acute leukemias than MDS for that very reason, I think, because tertiary care centers, both those taking care of just management of acute leukemia and those doing bone marrow transplant, often receive patients that started therapy in the community without appropriate cytogenetics being obtained.
I agree, and sadly, I see that way too often. I think this is a really important measure, and it's one that I would, with a great deal of pride, be able to take to our hematologists. I think we would be very enthusiastic backers of this.
This is Elaine. I can tell you that there was a technical problem with this, because the PQRI measures were office measures. So when the auditors came to our office and they asked me to pull from our practice management system a list of patients, Medicare patients, who had a diagnosis of acute leukemia, who were seen in the office, I came up with three patients. And I think, Tim, you can speak, but I think in Tim's practice, they came up with virtually none. The truth of the matter is that most of those patients present to the hospital and rarely leave it or aren't seen in the office very often. So I think it was not so much a problem with the quality of the measure as with capturing that patient population in an outpatient setting.
Sure, and I agree with you there. I think the practical implications of adequate data capture are tough. But, God, this is an important measure.
This is the labor. I thought that the measure actually emphasizes MDS and not other leukemia, so the language definitely needs to be changed.
I agree, and that was my big problem, is I love the header. I read it, and then as I got further into the body of the metric, it coned down very rapidly on MDS, and I think it really would achieve its greatest importance by redefining it or changing its description to include patients with MDS, AML, or ALL.
So I would, if one wants to be as inclusive, which I fully support, it would be maybe putting the MDS at the end, because then
yes.
Obviously it's a much broader thing.
Sure, I agree with you. I mean, I guess the only thing about putting MDS up front is if you're looking at the capturability of the data, you probably are getting more of a higher percentage of the MDS patients evaluated as outpatients. Whereas the acute leuks will end up in an ER or something, or admitted. I mean, maybe that was the rationale, but I agree 100% with what you just said.
Yeah, this is Tim Miley from Park Nicollet with ASH. I agree with Elaine. I don't remember our actual capture rate when we first did our runs, but it obviously to get your best return and to get as many of these patients involved, you have to be willing to go into the notes, because if some people have had cytogenetic analysis in the past, obviously they that's typically stated as part of their overall assessment in their clinic visit, but that requires obviously drilling into the actual text of the reports, which is more difficult than just grabbing numbers off of the lab data sheet. But if it's in the, if there is a cytogenetics report that exists that's unique and as part of the report, then obviously it's easier.
A more robust and straightforward measure if it were confined to MDS. It's a problem on the other side, but it's very difficult to collect the data.
It might be more of a challenge, but I think your metric is a lot more meaningful and important if you include all the entities rather than just MDS.
We heard a couple of recommendations about the focus of the measure and possibly settings. Is there someone from AMA-PCPI that can respond to those two issues?
Yeah, this is Sam Tierney. So the intent of the measure is that it would be more broad and would include patients with MDS as well as acute leukemias. And the specifications are constructed you know, according to that intent. You know, I apologize that the form didn't, and I certainly see the comments that the form really only seemed to focus on MDS in certain instances. So clearly we need to add more information from the guidelines for the acute leukemias. But the actual intent is that the measure is more broad in focus. And with regards to the comment about the capturability in office settings, I think that's a good one, and that's something that, you know, we could certainly confer. And unfortunately, our specification staff aren't on the phone, who are much more familiar with the coding that's included in the measure. But perhaps if we made some modifications to the codes that are included, because I believe they are all codes for office visits, then perhaps it might help with capturability and some of the feasibility concerns. So that's something that we could certainly consider.
Thanks, Sam.
Yeah?
Is there, sorry, I was just saying thank you to Samantha. But is there any other discussion on this in terms of a recommendation then?
So this is Bob Miller. I put eyes for the quantity, quality, and consistency of evidence question. What is this 1C? Because, you know, again, I don't want to be a stickler for the rules, but none of those questions were answered in this piece of paper. I mean, first of all, this is not my area of practice, but I absolutely agree with the science behind it. You got to do this. It's important. It needs to be measured. So there's little doubt about the face validity and the usefulness. It's just, you know, if all I had was this Word document, 1C5 is not answered at all. 1C6, which is the quality of the body of evidence, is non-responsive. And 1C7 says a statement that's true, but that doesn't really answer the question either. So if our job as work group members is to analyze what's present before us, I say we haven't been given enough information. There's no answer to a quantity of studies. If we're going to require that for all the measures, we should require that for this. Or, I mean, maybe we can vote not to do that, and I don't want to speak out of turn. This is my first time through, but that was my concern about several of these.
Well, I mean, just having reviewed this, I agree with everything you said. I thought that it needed to be augmented in the exact ways that you said, because those data do exist. It's just a matter of articulate them much more fully. The document was thin.
Agree.
So this is Sam Silver. I just have to say that last night was the first time I've read these documents, so I don't necessarily disagree with the need for additional information.
Yeah, this is Tim Miley. I agree. I think there's more out there that could be provided, obviously, if required. If needed, it's there.
Okay. Thank you. Any comments on that from the AMA PCPI?
This is Sam Tierney, and sorry to be speaking so much. I guess I just have one comment in general. And this is for the steering committee and to know for these forms, but also for our other forms. We at the AMA PCPI have a methodology of basing our measures on clinical practice guidelines. Over the past 12 years of activity, that's been our focus, and primarily because we recognize that individual research studies might come out that then later are contradicted by other studies. So we are challenged to answer the questions about quantity, quality, and consistency, because all that we have to answer those questions is what is provided in the guidelines. And the NCCN guidelines do have a rating scale, but they unfortunately don't get to the level of detail that would enable us to answer the questions in quantity, quality, and consistency. So just as a general comment, you know, because of our reliance on guidelines, answering those questions when the guideline developer doesn't provide that detail is a little challenging for us.
One thing that may be of help is at the end of those NCCN guidelines, there's a bibliography. And even sometimes the text portion of the NCCN metrics will have an articulation of numerators, denominators, and data to support that. I'm more familiar with that with the ALL guidelines in terms of the exact papers that are cited, but for the others, they're also there, and that may be helpful in fleshing out the measure further.
So this is Sam. I have to agree with that. Each of these guidelines has a